طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast that features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective that is largely missing in the news reporting and commentary brought to us through the Western media. This Week in Palestine brings you discussions of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The Palestinian voice we feature this week is that of Yasser Abu Jamai, director of the Gaza Mental Health Program. He is the successor to Dr. Iyad El Sarraj, who, until his untimely death, was a driving force and voice of the Gaza Mental Health Program, and who was featured often on This Week in Palestine. We spoke with Dr. Abu Jamai in an exclusive interview when he came to Boston on a speaking tour. Gaza, which has suffered many assaults by the Israeli military, is a traumatized population. No one in Gaza can escape the suffering brought on by the constant Israeli barrage, not even Dr. Jamai, who, in the latest assault named Protective Edge in the summer of 2014, lost 28 members of his family in a single bombing. Yet he and the staff of the Gaza Mental Health Program continue to serve the mental health needs of this traumatized society. Here is our interview with Dr. Yasser Abu Jamai. Dr. Yasser Abu Jamai, is that pronounced right? Yeah. Jamai?
It's Abu Jamai with I, but it's...
Jamai. Yeah. Well, thank you for your willingness to speak with us on This Week in Palestine. You're touring several cities with Rand Goldstein of the Physicians for Human Rights Israel. You'll be in the Boston area for a few days. Tell us what your goals are. What are you trying to accomplish with the two of you speaking together on this tour in the United States?
The idea started initially a few months ago. We have the youth organization called Rebuilding Alliance. And what they are trying to do is bring some people and speak on tours in the States. And actually, the first time I spoke to them personally was during the war in 2014. They called me, Donna Baranski Walker called me to offer condolences because during that war, 28 members of my extended family died just in one single attack. And she was just calling to offer condolences. And then with time we started to speak each now and then. So one of the issues that came to my mind, like, you know, people are very well aware of the physical impact of the offensive or the last war. However, you know, when the war is over, those physical things stop. You know, no more people are killed and no more buildings are destroyed. But people continue to suffer, so no one really pays sometimes good attention to the psychological impact, to the mental health impact of the last offensive on the people. And that's why people keep following up the hot stories, you know, what is wrong happening here, what's wrong happening there, and then they are just forgetting about how people live. And this is very important to say that this is not the first time that we were like exposed to these attacks. We had the 2008 attack, and then the 2012, and now the 2014, and we keep feeling like we get people's attention just for a very short time during and immediately after the attack stops, but later on no one really knows, and people start just forgetting, or their attention is shifting toward some other areas in the world. And, you know, now the world is full of hot stories. So part of it is just to come to speak to people, reminding them of the situation in Gaza Strip. Part of it is fundraising. Part of it is making new friends, you know, talking to people. And a very important part of it is to say, like me and Ran being together, that despite all of the difficulties that we both face in our work due to the occupation and the occupation violations of human rights, is that there is still hope, you know, and that even that the children in Gaza suffer and that the adults also suffer, but there is still some hope in there, you know. And that all efforts should be put in building that hope and expanding it more and more, further and further, unless it's otherwise it will be too late for any peace in the region or any good solution to what's happening there at the moment.
Well, we certainly have followed with horror the assaults on the Gazan people by the Israeli military. And we're constantly aware that Gaza is a virtual prison under which the entire population is forced to live. In the past, we have spoken with your predecessor, Dr. Iyad al-Sarraz, and have followed the work of the Gaza Mental Health Center, but many of our listeners are not familiar with your work. So I wonder if you would tell us about your practice at the Gaza Mental Health Center and particularly the conditions under which you work.
Well, Iyad al-Sarraj, he was working in the 80s in the only Gaza psychiatric hospital, and that was the only mental health facilities that would offer any kind of help and care to. It was the only facility available for people in Gaza Strip, you know, the only mental health facility. And, you know, a psychiatric hospital is good for, like, psychiatric emergent cases and people who are in chronic illnesses that have, like, who have symptoms like severe aggression, suicidal ideation, attempts, etc., etc. But it's not a good place for someone who is living under, like, oppression and have some issues regarding how to cope with these violations, like patients with post-traumatic stress disorder, patients who are depressed. A psychiatric hospital is not the right place for them to receive treatment. And it was the second, the first intifada then started, and it was going on. And he thought that we should approach people in a different way, you know, and that we should start a community mental health center where you could treat people in the community, work with them in the community, and offer them not only psychiatric consultation, but also psychologists could be working, social workers could be working, and nurses could be working. And that was the idea, to just shift from the strict biological model that you give a medication and that's it, to a more like community-based psychosocial model. And over the years, that proved to be very successful. However, you know, the living conditions in the Gaza Strip continue to deteriorate and deteriorate because we had then, you know, like just 6 years of peace between 1994 and 2000. And later on, the second intifada erupted, and then the siege started in 2007. And after the siege, you know, 1, 2, and 3 large scale attacks on the Strip. So over the years, this situation continued to deteriorate. And the question is, how do you help people in these circumstances? Well, we started with one clinic in Gaza City, but today we have 3 clinics, one in Gaza City, the other one in Deir al-Balah in the middle areas of Gaza Strip, and the third one is in Khan Yunis in the south. So through these three community centers, and by the way, we have more than 70 professionals who work on full-time. 70 people who work for us on full-time basis, and we have other people who come on short contracts, you know, like another like 20 to 30 people who are just on short contracts. So what we try to do is, first we offer services, specialized mental health care to men and women, males, females, and also to children and adults. We are almost the only one mental health, specialized mental health care provider who offers mental health care to children. So we have the facility and we have the skills to offer care to the children. In addition to that, you know, we were like a good model for people to see and learn from. So, like in the early 90s, we proved to be very effective, and people who were visiting, you know, people who were visiting from the States, from Europe, to give us some training, more capacity building, and more skills, they were too much happy with the work we were doing, and they thought that it's a good idea to start disseminating these skills and knowledge. So we started various capacity building programs within GCMHP. And we started a diploma in community mental health in the year 1997. That diploma, like, you have the intake on an annual basis of something like 15 professionals, 15 to 20 professionals, who are graduates of medicine, psychology, sociology, and nursing. And together you spend 1 year teaching them in a theoretical program, and then for the second year, you just put them into our residency program in our community centers.
And so you have your own training program.
We have our own training program. It's academically accredited, postgraduate diploma, high diploma in community mental health, and it's the academic accreditation comes from the Islamic University. So that's how we cooperate with the university regarding the certification.
The certificate.
And so far we have more than 180 graduates. Most of them work in school counselors, in schools as counselors, in some primary health care units and other health facilities. So one way or the other, although we have limited amount of professionals, but one way or the other we try to add more human resources in this field, in this area, through training others on how to become capable of providing services to people. And when we speak about offering services, it's not only the therapeutic services. Another service is the free telephone counseling unit. So people who are skeptic about coming to Gaza community mental health clinics, you know, stigma is all the time there.
Yes.
It keeps a challenge. It's a challenge all the time to mental health practitioners in all the world. But in that, we have some good news, because when we started in 1990, you know, we had zero referrals, self-referrals. So most of the referrals, all of them were coming from mental health, physicians and from health practitioners. However, this year we have something like 70% of our clients, our patients, are self-referred or family-referred, which means that we have done a great job in working with the stigma. Now, going back to the free telephone counseling unit, we thought that this is a good idea or a good way of allowing, you know, women and adolescents to approach us. And give more chance to marginalized people to talk to us if they cannot come to the clinic. And it's going also very well. At the moment, we have 65% of our clients are women, which is good. So we all the time, this is a good example of we all the time keep gender issues in our mind, you know, and we try to approach all the people, no matter, you know, in accordance with their needs. It's very important to say also that we also offer training programs to our CBOs, community-based organizations. So you have many community-based organizations across Gaza Strips. There are hundreds of them. And they work in small communities, in small neighborhoods. So what we do is that, we try to arrange various training courses to those people, because you need to increase awareness about mental health issues. And I'll give you one example. You know, if a child, you know, his school achievement started to decrease, or for example he started to become aggressive, then his parents will think that something is wrong with that child. Yeah. But they wouldn't think that it's a trauma or that he's afraid. They would think that this child is becoming misbehaving, you know, he's becoming more disobedient. While actually in many of the cases you just need to sit with the child and ask him to speak about, you know, his fears, you know, try to talk to him more, spend some more time with him.
Get to the root of the anger and the root of the problem, yeah,
and then solve it, and then that child will be able to continue a good education, you know, and then you are changing the whole life of a child is changing the whole life of a future family, you know. So you need to go and talk to the people, you know, offer them some guidance that sometimes, you know, if a child was great in his first class at school, if he's in the second grade, he's not doing well, it doesn't mean that he suddenly became like, you know, having problems. But you should think of some mental health issues and concerns. And that's why we talk to public in public, you know, we call to people and we talk to people in their neighborhoods. Sometimes we use the radio programs. Sometimes we go to the TV, we participate in TV shows, just bringing as much attention as possible to these issues. What really is challenging is that the conditions in Gaza are not improving, you know. The siege continues now since the year 2007. Parts of the siege like started to get like easier, like all food items can now get into Gaza, because for example for a certain time pasta was not even allowed to get into Gaza.
Food is getting in.
So food is getting in. You can import food, no problem with medication generally speaking. But the major problem now is with reconstruction material.
Right.
So during the attack, you know, OCHA reports speak about 18,000 residences that were fully destroyed, another 40,000 residences that were partially destroyed. And people are waiting for the reconstruction material to get into Gaza. And the first 1,000 unit, the announcement that it's going to start rebuilding the first 1,000 unit was just last June, almost 10 months after.
Yes, because I read that even though the international community had pledged quite a bit of money following the assault in 2014, reconstruction was just not happening. And the money seemed to be there. Was it because Israel will not allow the building materials to come through the checkpoints? Is it the problem getting the materials in? Or is the international community, you know, not giving the money it pledged to? What seems to be the problem in getting construction materials into Gaza?
Well, the first thing is that Israel wanted to make 100% sure that this is the argument, you know, the Israeli argument is that they want to make sure that the reconstruction material won't get into the wrong hands.
I see.
That's what they say. Mm-hmm. And so they were raising many security issues and concerns. And, you know, all the time, the only way for Gazans to receive goods, you know, is through Israel. There is no other way, basically.
Right. The tunnel economy is gone now.
Is gone. Of course, it ended since even before the last attack. So the what they were saying is that, you know, we want to ensure that this will not reach the wrong hands, and they had to reach an agreement with the international community and with the Palestinian Authority on how to allow reconstruction material getting into Gaza without, like, you know, making sure that the thing is not going to reach, the wrong people, or Hamas, like, or those. And they came out, the result of all of this was a very poor and slow reconstruction mechanism. And that's because, you know, it's a lengthy process. It takes a lot of time. So each one who's going to build a house or to rebuild his house has to report his, you know, location, submit the plan, the design, everything. They will count the material needed, and they will send you like one third of it. And then they will make sure that you use the one third of it. Then you apply, you get the second third of it. And then they come, they inspect, and then they come and check that everything is fine, and then they give you the third part of it. And this has to apply to each one who applies for a reconstruction material. And the other part of it, second part of it, is that the Israelis are not allowing enough trucks to pass into Gaza. So there is still limitation on the accessibility of this reconstruction material to Gaza. And third part of it, which is Some of the pledged money is not coming. You know, it's
not.
Yeah, some of the pledged money is not coming. So it's a complex, complicated issue. But I would say that, and basically speaking, this is not helping people, and people continue to suffer. You know, if more than 100,000 people lost their houses,
and the reconstruction is going family by family, not sort of block by block or area by area.
No.
It's one family at a time that applies. If accepted, gets a third of the money, a third of the money, etc. So this is a long process.
You know, the 18,000 residences were present across the whole Gaza Strip, you know. And sometimes they take, you feel like if you have in this neighborhood 50 houses were destroyed, like two of them got lucky this time, and people continue to wait, and I'm not sure really how they pick or which ones that they pick, but I think I'm not sure how that thing happens, but again the first 1,000 units started just June, and let's assume that that was 10 months after the ceasefire. And what about the other 17,000 residences, you know? And this is just the beginning of the reconstruction of the fully destroyed houses. So those 100,000 people, you know, you don't find any homeless person in the streets of Gaza. You know, there you went there more than once. You know, you don't ever see homeless people in Gaza. So they go to stay with their relatives. So these 100,000 people are impacting other people. And all of the people in Gaza Strip are living under siege. So living in, living out, like, you know, visiting others, like trying to travel abroad is not allowed. You know, some of the material is not allowed to get into Gaza, and it's just like, for example, engines for the fishermen are not allowed to get into Gaza. This is a very strange thing. What does a fisherman...
Engines
make?
for their boats?
For their boats, for the ships, for the boats. And, you know, we have small ships that because we are not allowed to go fishing that deep in the sea. You know, we have like a I don't know how they call it, 3 miles, you know, and that's it. And another story of it, or another part of it, is that there is an international report came recently, speaks about Gaza, and it fully describes how the situation in Gaza Strip, and it says simply that by the year 2020, Gaza will not be a good or inhabitable place anymore, you know. They speak about 90% of the people do not have access to safe drinking water, more than 70%. Percent of the people are totally dependent on international aid. You know, more than 45% of the people are unemployed. And when you look at the age 25 to 35, then it goes higher than 65%. And people continue to be desperate. You know, and there is no real development on the ground. What's happening is like a systematic de-development. And when you add on top of that the lack of electricity, you know, you get power something like 8 hours a day, and that's what you have.
So the problem of infrastructure is not being addressed. That is the water, the sewage, electricity. Are you saying that's not being addressed? That rebuilding is not going on, or
I couldn't say that it's addressed if the siege is going now for 7 years, you know, and if I still do not find good drinking water in Gaza Strip, you know, so whatever happens, there are many people who are trying to help one way or the other, but everything is going in a very slow motion, you know, as if the aim is not to allow people to grow. I'll put it in other words. Let's assume that there is, you know, like we are a free country. Let's assume that Gaza is free. It has its own like government, and we have no problem. Usually, you should keep up with the people increase in population. You know, so you need to improve, and you need to have more resources, more capacity, more like electrical power coming in, more water resources. But what happens in Gaza? It's not only that we have now almost 2 million people in there, which is like double what we had 15 years ago. But the problem is that the available resources are also decreasing because of the ongoing siege. So this is heavily causing the development of various sectors in Gaza Strip. And it touched the health sector in a very dramatic way, because part of it is that, you know, medical practitioners, you know, are not giving the chance to train abroad. You know, they are sometimes blocked from traveling. If there is an international conference you need to attend, sometimes you do not get the permit to that, because this is considered it's not a very important issue. Patients who are in Gaza Strip, you know, any patient in Gaza Strip who does not have the possibility to receive therapy in Gaza is offered by the PA. You know, the PA should cover his cost or her cost to travel abroad and receive treatment. And traveling abroad means Gaza, Egypt, West Bank, or Israel. Now, many of those people who apply do not get the permission.
Just can't get out.
Yeah, 20% of the people who apply to travel for health, they do not... In Israel, to go to Israel to receive health, they are not getting that permit.
20%,
yeah. And Ran was saying that more than 200,000 people apply on annual basis to receive permit to receive medication or to travel for medication. If you calculate 20% of them, that leaves you with something like 40,000 people. And the other problem of it, like, sometimes if you do not have a life-saving... if you do not need a life-saving intervention, then this is not an emergency. So you cannot be referred immediately. You know, you need to wait for the application. You need to get the cost covered from the PA, and then you need to apply, and then you need to wait until that application is approved and you are receiving the permit. Another part of the story is the destruction that took place to some of the primary healthcare units, some of the hospitals during the offensive. So it's not only lacking personnel, it's not only like lacking trained people, but it's sometimes not only lacking the equipment, but sometimes even some of the buildings are partially destroyed because it was targeted during the attacks. The main rehabilitation building, the main rehabilitation hospital that we had in Gaza Strip, Al-Wafa Hospital, was completely demolished during the war. And now, you know, you don't have that proper rehabilitation facility in the strip.
In terms of education, the Palestinian people, historically among the most educated people, and I'm wondering what's happening in terms of educating not only the children in Gaza, but also the ability of students to study at the university level, what's available in Gaza, and what problems do they face trying to leave Gaza, to go to medical school, to go to law school, engineering school, whatever. How does that impacting on the Gazan population and sort of the future of education?
Yeah. Well, you know, we don't have that many resources in Gaza. And for Palestinian people, you know, we all think that the best investment that you could make is like to invest in your children's education. So then your child will have the chance, the possibility maybe to earn a job and to make a life in the future. That's why all Palestinian people, they stress on their children. And they try to empower their children, and they are like, we are like pushy, you know. We need our children to get the higher marks, not only to pass the grades. And that's why many of the children who has, you know, whose grades start to decrease, they just, their parents start to dig, what's the problem, you know, and they come to us in order to help them, to help their children overcome the challenges they face. But when it comes to university education, you know, we had something like two main universities in Gaza before the PA started, and now we have like five or six universities who offer a variety of faculties. including now we have medical faculty of medicine. But the problem is that first, the quality of education is a big question, because you know there is serious development that takes place in all aspects of science, you know.
Yes.
And if you are not up to date with these things, you know, what's the benefit of training people on old methodologies, for example? And if you go to a hospital, you find physicians applying something that was, or using medications that used to be used in the 80s and 90s, while you are now in 2015. So you need to keep up with the development and updates, and that doesn't really take much place. The other part of it is that for postgraduate education, okay, we have two schools of medicine, but we don't have higher education, like for masters, for PhDs, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to physicians. Now that is lacking, and you know, sometimes you can apply for international universities, and sometimes you get a seat in there, but it becomes a big challenge how you are going to travel abroad.
Yeah, we constantly hear stories about people getting into universities, even getting scholarships, etc., yeah. but then yeah. not able to get out,
yeah.
and the fear that if they get out, they won't be able to get back in.
Yeah. Well, that question was a very big one, and for many years this continued to be a remarkable problem, and as part of the siege and blockade. Now, recently there is some improvement, you know, like the Ministry of Civil Affairs, the Palestinian Ministry of Civil Affairs, tried one way or the other to keep in communication with the Israeli government and allow some of the students to leave. And this happens now, it happens every now and then. But again, this is not like a solution to the story, you know. The solution is very simple. The international law gives everyone the chance to leave. Once, you know, if you have a visa, if you have a scholarship, then it's your right to travel and go to that country, the country that offered you a place and a stay and a visa, you know. So what's happening now is against the international law. Everyone knows this. And the very simple solution is just to allow people travel and lift the blockade. Just lift the blockade, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Allow the borders to work like any other places in the world. I was in while traveling, I would say, sometimes you tell people, you know, well, it might be difficult to get back, and you need like a permit and the coordination to get back on a very specific day. And they say, what? You need a permission to go where? I say, to Gaza. But you will be going back home. Well, still you need a permit. And this is the fact, you know. If I'm going back in Gaza on like 10th or 11th, then I should say the specific date, and I should tell them like 1 week at least in advance, and they will make sure that I get the permit to go back to Gaza on that day. If you left through, for example, Rafah borders, through Egypt, then you cannot go back through Jordan, for example, you know. Like, you need to be, your chances are extremely limited, and the possibilities to plan and to think about the future when it comes to travel is almost not there. So, also what really impacts the health system is that some of the brilliant physicians who work in Gaza, you know, these were some of them, like graduates of U.S. Universities, of English universities, of German universities. They are really brilliant. They kind of, some of them lost hope and just started to find some other places to go to. And this is, again, heavily impacting the health system in Gaza, because if the brilliant ones are also leaving, then what's going to be like in 2 or 3 years? If one hospital is impacted, you know, during the attack, then you are left with lesser hospitals that could serve the people, you know. And that's how the things continue to take place.
The United Nations has had responsibility for educating a lot of the children in Gaza. Are they still heavily involved in the schools? Are the schools open and adequate?
70% of the people who live in Gaza Strip are refugees. among those, 52% of all the population in Gaza Strip are children. So now we are speaking about something like 900,000 children who live in Gaza Strip.
900,000
yes.
children.
Most of them are in school age, and they need education. The UNRWA is currently still operating schools for refugees from the first grade until the ninth grade. When it comes to the 10th, 11th, and 12th grades, these are only for the Ministry of Education. And I think more than 250,000 children, they receive education at the UNRWA schools. One of the problems that face the UNRWA, it's like, again, like the Palestinian Authority, we keep all the time hearing about shortages of support. And here we come, we talk about financial support. So you are deprived of your rights. You are living under education, under occupation. And sometimes there is a big chance that your children lose the possibility to receive good education. And this keeps happening every now and then. And I think UNRWA was just facing some difficulties in raising funds for the education system. They all the time are under budgeted. And we had a big issue, I think a couple of months ago. The UNRWA said that it might either need to delay the beginning of the schooling year or simply has to fire some of the school teachers because of the lack of funds.
Funding for the United Nations. Increasing problems in Gaza and less and less money coming through the United Nations.
It's less and less money coming to the PA, less and less money coming to the United Nations, and less money coming to any place. I think it's that's why we think that Gaza is forgotten. Less money is coming in because more money goes to the other places, and you need to keep raising this issue. If you were exposed to a devastating war, then when it's over, it's not over, actually. It keeps many things in people's minds. And when you do not allow people to reconstruct and rebuild their destroyed houses, then it becomes a totally different story. If you don't allow reconstruction material to get into the people neighborhoods, then nothing is going to change. If people continue to walk among the rubble, there are many efforts in rubble removal that took place. But still, now we are 14 months after the ceasefire, still, rubble is still in Gaza in many places, and that rubble is polluted. Explosive material is explosive material. No matter what's in there, it's still polluted. It's toxic. Basically, it's toxic, and people just breathe there, they walk through there. And the ironic thing about this is that now we are having the second winter after the war.
Right.
And this water, the rains, is going to wash these toxins and send them down to the ground. And what's in the ground?
Pollute the water.
They will pollute the water. And the ironic thing is that it's not only us who drink from that water.
Yeah.
It's Palestinians and Israelis who drink from that water. And I wouldn't think that any clever politician will really attack a land that will end up polluting his water, and the water for his own people. But unfortunately, how politics sometimes work. And our sewage is dumped into the seawater sometimes because we do not have the resources and the possibilities of purifying it.
So it's polluting the Israeli beaches,
And yes, the Israeli,
they talk about their beaches.
Yes, and they are swimming in that pollution. So it's really ironic. And I do not find means of understanding why we keep, the Israelis keep thinking of that the military solution is the right one, while there is the other very basic thing, the simple one, which is just give people their freedom. That's it.
Yeah, right.
It's very simple.
They're fouling their own nest and creating enormous problems for themselves, and they don't have the long view, that's for sure. Well, how can we in the United States, how can we help the Gaza Mental Health Center? I know there's a foundation here, the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. It's a tax-deductible organization, and we can contribute there. What else do the American people need to do to help
Well, I'll tell you many things. Like, first of all, like, people who could donate through organizations like the Gaza Mental Health Foundation make a big difference. For example, during the previous years, we used to give medications free of charge to people. And this used to cost something like $90,000 to $100,000 a year. Last year, due to the increased need after the offensive, that money grew to $125,000. And of course, we rely on, we are a non-governmental organization, non-profit organizations, and we are completely independent. Independent, we just work for the sake of helping people. That's how Yad Sarraj established us, and that's how we continue to be. So we rely basically on donations that come from generous governments and generous people. So this is an important part of it, and there are many important other areas of it. Like, for example, if people can't come to Gaza, they would not only show solidarity, but they would also be able to offer training to the people who are there. And it doesn't matter, you know, you can come as a mental health practitioner, as a psychiatrist, you could come and offer some training. You can also come as a psychologist and offer some training. If you think that you are not good at training, or training is not your, like, you are not fan, you know, it's, some people, they don't just like to sit in lectures and give lecturing, then you just come and hear the stories. You just offer us then a sort of care for caregivers. Because one of the issues that we all the time think about is secondary traumatization, you know. We were living in Gaza. Well, for 51 days, those 50,000 shells who were falling in Gaza, we were there, basically. We were hearing the loud explosions every now and then. Some of us lost his beloved people. I lost many of my family, extended family members. There are many others who lost people and lost property. So, and we keep hearing the bad stories coming from the people who lost their houses and their beloved ones. So we are at extreme risk of developing secondary traumatizations and becoming traumatized ourselves.
Yeah.
So when some people come and offer just to hear us, to listen to us, and offer sort of care, that is also important. And again, some of the people who are into education, they are more than welcome to come, help us train the high diploma students, you know, help give guidance to people who come and receive training from the CBOs. And there are many other creative ways, you know. People think in a creative way, like Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. They just organize a trip on an annual basis to Gaza. They bring like 15 to 20 professionals. They come from various disciplines, including surgeons, including cardiologists. And they offer a wide spectrum training, you know, to many people. And we help them work with other institutions. So think creatively, you know. We say in Gaza that we still hope that there is a chance. And we work into expanding that hope in people's hearts and people's, you know, minds. So if we are not losing hope, you also should not lose hope. Mm. And you should be more creative than us. And I'm sure that you will not, you will all the time find different means of helping people in Gaza. We are organizing an international conference in Gaza, and that international conference is going to take place in the coming April. The announcement is made, it's on our website. Our website is www.gcmhp.net, and people who are interested to go to Gaza to submit abstracts to go to that conference, please go ahead and just contact the coordinator, the conference coordinator.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, Yasser, we've reached the end of our time, unfortunately. Thank you for speaking with us, and thank you for the work you do, and we hope that we will see you in Gaza.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Dr. Yasser Abu Jamai, Director of the Gaza Mental Health Program. You can support this important work and keep in touch with the Gaza Mental Health Program through the website of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. Just Google Gaza Mental Health Foundation, a local tax-deductible foundation, to stay in touch. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine. a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or listen to us anytime via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., click on Listen, and you will hear the program. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts at any time, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.